A lot of neat things to think about, including a great legacy of Spokane, which is going to really come to a fore, has already come to a fore, with an exhibit at the Museum of Arts and Culture and then a presentation that's happening tonight at 5:30. And we're going to get to that soon enough, but we're going to begin with another aspect of the relationship between Spokane and Abraham Lincoln. Before we get to the main menu, here is kind of the warm-up. This was the commission piece for the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln, commissioned by the Spokane Symphony, Letters from Lincoln, written by Michael Dougherty, sung by Thomas Hampson. And this is one of the cute little openings that sets the stage. Well, the title, Tom will let us know. Here it goes.
Abraham Lincoln is my name, and with my pen I wrote the same. I wrote in both haste and speed, and left it here for fools to read. Abraham Lincoln, his hand in pen, he will be good, but God knows when. Swift as an Indian arrow, fly like a shooting star. Swift as an Indian arrow, fly like a shooting star. Abraham Lincoln is my name, and with my pen I wrote the same. I wrote in bold haste and speed, and left it here for fools to read. Abraham Lincoln, his hand and pen, he will be good, but God knows when. God knows when, God knows when, God knows, God knows. If I were two-faced, would I be wearing this one?
Part of his Letters from Lincoln, a great legacy of Spokane. Spokane Symphony commissioned that for the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln. But it builds on a great tradition, and that's where we're going, and that is to that fabulous Lincoln portrait in the original two-word meaning of Lincoln portrait that was in Lincoln Savings Bank on Lincoln Street in Spokane for all of those years. And it was Don Lindsay who made it happen, and his daughter Karen Warwick is with us. And Karen, what a treat to have you here. Hello, good morning.
Thank you.
And so we need to know, well, first I'll say a little bit about Lincoln Bank and then you can fill it in. But I thought it was so amazing that the main office was on Lincoln Street, the north side office, the back side of it was on Lincoln Street, the south side office was at 14th and Lincoln. And I don't know, what was the cart and what was the horse? Did they name the bank after the streets, or did they just find good streets to put the bank? Do you know any of that stuff?
I know I have an inkling about the history. The bank started in 1920 with my grandfather, and it was first located on Wall Street across from the Crescent Department Store. Mm-hmm. And the size of the building was like a shoebox. It was just this little narrow bank. And the bank did well. My grandfather died at 53, so my dad and my uncle, Rod Lindsay, had to come back from school and run the bank. And with that, everything exploded because housing was vital. It was just a good time to be in banking. So what happened is that my dad and his brother had to build the Lincoln Building, which is on Lincoln Street. So we got off of Wall Street, got to Lincoln Street, and there it was the setting for the Rockwell portrait, because all of a sudden the bank was a big deal. The lobby was beautiful, full of teak wood, and if you remember, teal carpeting. There was a big globe in the lobby, mm-hmm. But there was this blank wall up behind the teller cages. I don't even know if you call them that anymore. But and my dad had a vision. He thought, something needs to go on that wall. And he thought, oh, gosh, I wonder if it'd be possible. I think I'll write to Norman Rockwell and see if he would do a portrait of a young Lincoln for us. And Norman Rockwell was gracious enough, and the timing was right. He said he'd be glad to do that. So, of course, my dad was beside himself. And that's how it all began. I feel like I'm coming full circle with all of this because that painting was a big part of our family. And it's gone away. It's now in Youngstown, Ohio, and now with this wonderful exhibition, it's come back.
So. Oh yeah, and we're going to get into all the things about the exhibition, but a couple more things about the bank because I've always kind of wondered. Once it was the Lincoln Savings Bank, and slightly crass question, but was adopting Abraham Lincoln as a figure a good marketing ploy? Or did it come out of some deep love and respect for Abraham Lincoln, or probably some set of both?
I would guess, knowing my dad as I did, and I didn't know my grandfather, that there was something tugging at the heart with that. We had pictures of the original lobby, and you know, back in the 30s and so forth. And doing research for this, I got the picture out, and sure enough, at the end of that little shoebox, that lobby, there's a big photograph of Abraham Lincoln at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. And I was just thrilled when I saw that. I thought, oh, my goodness. Way back then, Lincoln was, very important to the bank. And then coming with the Rockwell painting that enforced it, and then there was a big collection of memorabilia that was also part of the bank.
That was right there free for everybody to see. You just walked into the bank and saw it all.
Yeah. I mean, a pillowcase from Lincoln's, a bloody pillowcase, part of it, from Lincoln's deathbed. A number of things, anyway. That whole feeling of old-fashioned integrity. And, of course, if you look at Lincoln and think about Lincoln, it's hard work, it's character, it's education. The man only went to school for 3 years, formally. But look at his mind and what he came from.
Yeah, and so what a great legacy. And it was so beautifully done with a display in Lincoln Savings Bank, as it later was called. And then that audacious idea to use Norman Rockwell. And for those of us looking forward to the Saturday Evening Post every week, the look of the Saturday Evening Post, the look of what of how we interpreted our civilization was the vision of Norman that Norman Rockwell gave us, wasn't it?
It was wonderful. I was telling Abigail, I would stay overnight at my grandmother's house, and I'd get into bed with her, and I mean, I was just small, and we had the Saturday Evening Post always when I was there, mm-hmm. and we'd just look at the cover. Mm-hmm. We didn't even have to open the magazine. Mm-hmm. It was the cover that was the heartstring.
Yeah. And so that takes us so beautifully, and this is so thrilling, to the granddaughter of Norman Rockwell. Welcome, Abigail Rockwell.
Hi, it's wonderful to be here.
And we'll get into the whole idea of the book, and we'll get there very, very soon, the autobiography and the way you've redone it. But first, let's start with you as a kid, knowing that you had this famous grandfather who had done that. What were your early memories of him and of his work?
I when you're young, I don't think any of us were aware of his fame.
He was just Grandpa.
He was just Grandpa, and we called him Pop. The three sons called him Pop, and then we all sort of adopted it. So all the grandchildren call him Pop. All the great grandchildren call him Pop. And he did have advanced Alzheimer's or advanced dementia in his final years. So, as you know, with dementia, I mean, I think it touches mm-hmm. all of our lives. Mm-hmm. The person tends to retreat. So the last 5 years of his life was a very retreated existence for him. So the memories I have of him are almost more sensorial. His pipe smoke, the smell of his pipe smoke, to this day, if I go down the street and someone is smoking a pipe, which is such a rarity now, I'll stop transfixed, because that smell brings me right back to the living room and cocktail hour with Pop and the macadamia nuts. And I think one of my favorite things was when I went out to visit his studio, which was right on the property next to the house in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. It had this wonderful smell of turpentine and oil paints mixed with, it was sort of a heady mixture mixed with the pipe smoke. That's my only issue. They have the studio at the Norman Rockwell Museum now, and my only issue is that they don't have the terp smell. So it's really missing something with the pipe smoke and the terp smell.
Well, that smell is one of the deepest things we have.
Yeah. So those are my memories. I really wasn't aware of the fame. I don't even remember seeing the Saturday Evening Post at that point.
Well,
I mean, he had long since stopped painting for them. His house didn't have Saturday Evening Posts there. I didn't grow up with Saturday Evening Post, so I was removed from that. And there were, you would just get little shadows of his fame in the way other people would treat him. That they would treat him as this, I have to say, it's almost like a godlike figure. I mean, mm-hmm. he was just beloved and adored. And now he's sort of seen as this iconic figure. But to me, he's still my wonderful, faulted, supremely talented grandfather.
And I'm speaking with Abigail Rockwell, Norman Rockwell's granddaughter. And then for some time context, the painting that we're talking about commissioned in 1964, but the autobiography was from 1960, I believe.
Right, exactly.
And let's go to that, because that's precisely why you're in town. He created an autobiography in 1960. It came out. And then you have gotten very involved with it. And You've done things with it. Tell us about what it was when it came out, what it lacked, and what you have provided for it.
Well, it's now seen as a classic autobiography, and it's always been this wonderful sort of stream of anecdotal stories of Pop and his paintings and his life, and it's remarkably open and candid. I think he has a wonderful chapter on his friend J.C. Leindecker, who was also his mentor, his artistic mentor, because Leindecker was one of the hugest illustrators, especially in the 20s. So Pop really looked up to Leindecker. That's one of the most touching, honest, candid chapters in the whole book. So there's surprising openness at that time. It's 1960. He did it under the mantle of the Saturday Evening Post. I believe it started because they wanted him to write some of the stories of some of his more famous paintings. And he started sort of writing it down, and then he brought my dad in. And the material was so voluminous that I think they sort of contacted Ken Stewart and the Saturday Evening Post, and they said, you know, we have so much stuff here.
We need an editor.
I think we need an editor, but I think we also need to, maybe there's a memoir here. Maybe there's something more here. So because it was done under the mantle of the Saturday Evening Post, there's a certain restriction with that. So it's not going to be a psychological tell-all. And as Pop said, it's not going to be, you know, some psychological sex drama tell-all. You know, that's not what it was. So the first edition came out. It was wonderfully received. There was a second edition in 1988. And I ended up having to do this quite lengthy investigation, because there was a falsified biography that came out on Pop in 2013. It's now out of print, and I discovered she was falsifying the sources, but I couldn't discover that until I investigated. And it's one of those things where, I'll just do a little investigation. You know, you just think, I'll just, on the surface, I'll just do a little. but there's no such thing as a surface investigation. But the source that I started with was his autobiography, because my dad, who co-wrote the autobiography with Pop, my dad, Tom Rockwell, he's the middle son of Norman. Norman had three sons. He's the one who said, you know, I want you to edit this. And in my investigation, I discovered that the second edition had bizarrely omitted text, changed some text. They omitted the charming chapter heading drawings that Pop specifically drew for the autobiography. Inexplicably, they left them out. They also left out the beautiful, really touching dedication to my grandmother, Mary. And he did a beautiful pencil drawing of her portrait and just put a touch of yellow in the ribbon in her hair, you know, almost like tie a yellow ribbon around the you know. And so I think we saw a chance to really restore and even improve upon the first edition, because the first edition didn't have illustrations added. It just had the chapter heading drawings. So, and Abbeville Press, who published this definitive edition, they were absolutely open to the suggestions that I made. And so my dad asked me to edit it. You know, it's one of those things, you sign up for something, you don't quite know what you're signing up for. I think in my head I was thinking, oh, somebody else will do the illustration part, and maybe I'll write the introduction. And, you know, it's one of those things. But then you realize, if I don't do it, you know, it's going to be delegated to somebody who might not take quite as much care. And because of my investigation with the other biography, and then it became my own investigation, you start doing more and more out of love of the work and love of discovering about your grandparents. And also, you discover so much about yourself by doing that. It's extraordinary. I mean, I recommend it to everybody to try to delve into their families and find those old letters. So we had a chance to really do something with it. So I think it's about 170 plus illustrations that I curated. And I really wanted to choose illustrations that showed a much more comprehensive, expansive view of his work, not just the typical ones that everyone knows, that everyone can grab their phone and Google. You know, show the lesser known work, show the gorgeous color study that he did of an Indian woman in 1962. I think he did it in you know, when he was traveling. Stunning. And then just the lesser known ones that people haven't seen. So they get a broader view of what his work was, because I wanted to show him not just as this painter of, quote, Americana, which is so often the media dubs him that, people, that's sort of what they think of him, as I was curating him as a painter, as an illustrator, and somebody who always strove so deeply to expand his own technique, his own work. And I think that's what differentiates him from some of the other illustrators. Leyendecker, for instance, never really grew past that certain magnificent technique he got, but he never moved beyond that. He still kept with the same subjects. Pop was constantly trying different techniques. He would try on the techniques of the young up-and-comers, John Falter and Al Parker, just to sort of try it on for size, try their different color lots, their different techniques, their different angles. So I also made an effort to restore the text. I made sure that it was faithful to the first edition. I actually didn't know that could happen, that a text could actually be changed inexplicably. Nobody asked my dad. You know, it was 1988. They should have asked my dad, oh, we're going to omit this and then change these lines here and then change these lines here. I actually didn't know that could happen. So I made sure that the text was fully restored. I also wrote an introduction. It's like 11 pages. A lot of new information about Pop that nobody has ever known.
Abigail Rockwell, the Pop in question is Norman Rockwell. And you've implicitly answered most of this, but that idea that somebody whose work came to us every week, right there on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, which was the iconic America, bit of America. You weren't a true American unless you looked at the Saturday Evening Post every day in the 50s, every week in the 50s. And so we take it for granted. Oh, isn't that pretty? There's another pretty Norman Rockwell thing. And yet, with you having had that opportunity to really examine it, that line between the commercial, the quick ephemeral art, and the stuff that's meant to last, you must have had given a lot of thought to that.
I have, and that's why I curated his work in the definitive edition the way I did. And a lot of people have noticed it and were so thankful. I didn't know he did this work. It's not just this pretty view of America. Yes, he was painting the world that was around him, especially when he went up to Arlington, Vermont in the 40s. He was painting a lot of the townspeople and that life there. It happened to be very white there. People don't know that there was a stricture placed upon his work and all the illustrators by Saturday Evening Post that they couldn't paint anybody, you know, an African-American, anybody of darker color, in anything but a subservient position. It was headed up for many, many years by George Horace Lorimer, who was from Kentucky. So I don't know specifically who put that stricture on there, but people don't realize that. So Pop would sneak in people of color into the paintings. You know, the soldier's homecoming, most people know that. He's the red-haired soldier that's coming home, and there's the tenement. It's a beloved one, and then it kind of looks like an Irish family. They're all redheaded. And he put himself in the door. So that's, to me, him saying, oh, I'm one of you. Oh, I'm no different than you. I'm right there. I'm right in the mix. And then in the tree, there's an African-American boy waving. There's another boy waving. There's some women in the window that could be possibly Italian, could be Jewish, but there's this feeling of I think he really made an effort to make it multicultural, but he had to sort of sneak it in, you know, so it's almost not noticeable. Jane Ellen Petrick wrote a good book of research about Hidden in Plain Sight, how Pop had to sort of sneak in these things to sort of get around that dictum of the Saturday Evening Post. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It does. No, that's exactly because there are aspects of dismissing Norman Rockwell.
Oh, absolutely.
That can be done. And so just to really catch and really understand maybe why, you know, why people would dismiss, like you say, the images he had to create and the very whiteness that he had to amplify.
Almost. Right. Yeah. And I think as you get to understand his biography intimately, in 1950, he painted what I consider his masterpiece, Shuffleton's Barbershop. You might know it. It's the one where it's the darkened barbershop. There's the darkened secondary room where the barbers, you know, clip the hair. But then in the back room, it's lit up. And it's exciting, and the musicians are playing. And it shows his removal from that joy of creativity. And I know that in 1950, it was a very dark time with the family because my grandmother, Mary, suffered very greatly, very acutely, from a kind of mental fragmentation. I tend not to like the name mental illness. Mm. I think most fragility comes from a fragmentation that she suffered a trauma when she was young, and then it sort of reared its head in the 40s, and the family had to go into this cycle of dealing with her mental illness. So Shuffleton's, to me, is really that whole period of paintings from 1948 to about 1954 when he painted Saying Grace, Shuffleton's Barbershop, Girl at Mirror. Most of you would know these if you Google, you'll recognize them instantly. Also Breaking Home Ties. It was the synthesis of extraordinary technique. He went to L.A. in the late 40s. And again, this is not an artist who rested on his laurels. He was constantly looking for new techniques. So my dad told me he learned from Joe Manieni, who was an artist in L.A., very gifted artist, a technique of the old masters. It was a multiple glazing technique. So I think between that and then this deepening of his emotional life in having to deal with my grandmother and in having to make sure that the three boys were somehow growing up safe and healthy and as well adjusted as you can be when you're dealing with that kind of difficulty in the home, she was self-medicating with alcohol. So it's there's this whole other layer and depth to his work that people just don't see. You know, he painted over 4,000 paintings. So you just can't make this quick assumption of, oh, he's over-sentimental. And, you know, he was a commercial illustrator. So much of the work has to reflect the sentiment of the times, the trend of the times, and also the advertisers and the editors. But it's when he did the storytelling, especially with the gift of those post covers later on, that's where the storyteller in him really, I think, flowered.
Abigail Rockwell on her father, Norman Rockwell.
Oh, grandfather.
Grandfather, yeah. You're not that old, no. You weren't even here in 1960. But on her grandfather, Norman Rockwell. And so thank you. What a great illumination. And so much more illumination will happen this afternoon at 5:30 at the Museum of Arts and Culture when you've come to town and you'll be talking about this and much more. And to come full circle and engendered by this great painting that was at Lincoln Savings Bank. I think it's said the largest Norman Rockwell painting ever of the young Abraham Lincoln holding his book and being studying and learning all that. And thank you, Karen Warwick, for illuminating that side of what many of us who are here in Spokane a few decades ago got to enjoy so much. Wasn't it great?
Thank you. Keeping the legacy alive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. Thanks a lot. And finally, with you, Abigail, so you, whether you wanted to or not, got pushed into becoming a writer and an editor and a book creator. Now that project's done, do you get to go back to your day job as a jazz singer?
Well, it was actually funny because I think it was published. It was fun. We kept changing the publication date, or Abbeville did. But it was published mid-May, and then a month later, I had my debut at Birdland Jazz Club in New York City, which is, you know, one of the great jazz clubs in the world.
West 54th, I think.
44th, yeah. 44th, yeah. Okay. It's moved through the years. Yeah, you know, that's not the original site. And I had four of the most stellar musicians, you know, top flight, amazing jazz musicians with me. So that was a real gift. And then I did the book signings in the summer, and I just did Elane Casino Resort. I did a concert and book signing 2 weeks ago.
You're not quite sure which one you are.
I think I have to accept that, you know, I got a lot of hats on, and you know, I'm just going to keep juggling them.
Great way to live, isn't it?
Yeah. Really. Well, you've done that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a wonderful way to live, to do a lot of different things. And they will have books at the MAC tonight?
I think so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay. And,
so. I will be signing books.
Okay, so that's at 5:30 at the Museum of Arts and Culture. What a treat. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.